Today's discussion is about pricing practices for attorneys. Toby Brown is a former director of the Utah State Bar and currently the director of strategic pricing and analytics for Akin Gump, a top 50 Am Law law firm. Toby is at the forefront of developing alternative fees, helping his firm set prices so that the client and the law firm are mutually benefited and act as partners. Toby has a great combination of executive-level skills in the area of technology, law, and economics.
Toby is a pioneer in the field of legal pricing. In fact, he's gathered a group of folks who work in similar functions around the country for a conference that will be held the 1st and 2nd of October 2013 in Chicago. And if you have the opportunity and you're near Chicago at that point, I would urge you to attend. It is a remarkable concept, one that's long overdue in our industry. And along those lines, our topic today is how to price legal services. Toby, thanks for joining us today. I appreciate your willingness to participate.
Thank you for having me.
Now, we know that there are a number of methods of pricing. Obviously, the one that's been in vogue for a number of decades is hourly pricing, hourly billing. We've got flat fees. We've got contingency. Many of our major clients ask for discounts. We've also got a new concept coming on, although it's been talked about for many years, called value-added. Are there other methodologies we should be aware of or think about in our conversations?
Well, I think you've covered the major categories there. I would, you know, if I were going to elaborate on it, I would say that, you know, you have to be creative, because sometimes it's not just, oh, we're going to do a fixed fee. It might be a fixed fee with a success fee. You know, some people might say, oh, it's a discount. Well, it might be a discount that's a variable discount, where there's a greater discount on partners than there are on associates. So there's, you know, you've covered the major categories, but the variations on that, those themes can grow the list quite a bit, actually.
Well, in the mid-60s, when I started practicing law, there was a posting, if that's the right word, by bar associations that indicated what different practice areas were customarily being charged out at. And, of course, the Supreme Court said that that was illegal, it was anti-competitive and so forth. And so lawyers, especially the small firm lawyers, are sort of left adrift, not quite sure how to set a fee. How is it that either in the large firm or the small firm, where they use hourly rating, let's use that as a starting point, where they use hourly billing, how do you set that fee? Is it based on any metric, or it's just a number pulled out of the air?
Oddly, I get that question a lot. There's a couple of ways of approaching that. I mean, and you can approach it from the client side and the law firm side. From the law firm side, there are a number of ways of saying, how are we going to build? And, you know, let's call it from, you know, step one, a budget, because we want to come up with a basic budget for a matter, and then say, okay, how does that relate to pricing? Is that how will clients react to that number? Because you're starting to allude to a challenge for the industry. And my educational background is economics, and so when we start to delve into these topics, my economics filter turns on. And I think you've hit it, that this is a challenge for both small and large firms, and it's that our market is used to pricing things by the hour. So that when you adjust and say, let's say I want to do a fixed fee for, you know, it could be everything from a divorce to a large commercial litigation, now we're going to start putting out numbers where it's really hard for the market to say that's a fair price for a divorce or a fair price for complex commercial litigation. And so when you start, you create a budget and say, okay, here's a foundation for it, then let's talk about what factors might drive that number up or drive that number down, or if we're looking at it from the client side, what, you know, when they look at that number, are they going to see it as a, you know, a value proposition that matches in their mind what they think.
It's interesting.
Like that should cost.
It's interesting because you bring in a number of factors that I think most of our listeners, large or small firm, probably don't recognize, or if they recognize, don't do. Number one, it's the idea of creating a budget. I don't know how many lawyers create a budget. When I consulted with one of the major firms a number of years ago, I instituted a budget for them. It was a foreign concept, and it was because they then had to have a budget and get the client's approval for that budget that they stopped losing money on AR, on accounts receivable, where clients, you know, said, hey, I never knew it was going to cost that much, or you didn't tell me that, or, you know, I don't care about your hourly rate, but I didn't think it was going to cost that much. And I agree that budgets are important. I don't know still today, though, how many firms actually implement a budget. And the other thing that you mentioned was sort of a sensitivity to the number, and if I read between the lines, it's that number might change one client to another. In other words, just some flexibility because of your creativity of how much sophistication might be required or how much time, effort, expertise might be required. And my experience has been that a firm has a number. Now, they may have two or three numbers, but they have a number, and that's it, and they don't think about it once they set it. Am I wrong?
No, I would say you are right. And I'll, to sort of address both the budget side and that client side, what I could do is sort of walk you through what my life is like typically. And I'll take one step back. I have had this role at three Am Law 50 firms, so I have a bit of a diverse experience from different practices and different perspectives. However, this process is somewhat universal. A lawyer will call me and say, okay, a client is asking for a fixed fee or a budget or what have you, and the first thing they want me to do is go into our time and billing system and pull similar matters so that I can tell them what the fee, what the price, or what the budget needs to be. And after doing that numerous times, I generally say, let's not do that, because my experience is, well, A, we can't go pull. I can't go pull the matters, you know, and to simplify this. In fact, this actually happened one time. They said, go pull single plaintiff employment litigation. And I said, I can't because we don't classify our work that way. And they're like, oh, well, why not? And I'm like, well, when you open new matters, do you classify it by type of work and industry and stuff like that? And they're like, well, no. And so my point is we've never had to do it that way. So even if they can give me, and I'm going to give you the actual numbers here. So this group gave me 35 matters, and the fees on those matters range from $9,000 to $900,000. And there was no sort of bell curve that said the magic number is, you know, $100,000 or whatever it might have been. There was no number. And I found that over and over and over again. And the reason being is that some litigation settles in 2 months, some goes through trial, some becomes very complex because some factor is raised. You know, it might have started out as a simple single plaintiff employment, and then all of a sudden the class is identified. So there's all these variations that can occur. And so there's rarely have I ever found that sweet spot to say this kind of work costs X dollars. So what do we do? Well, there's a couple of ways of attacking a budget. The hard way is to build it on a task basis and say, okay, we're going to depose 10 people. We're going to depose, you know, 2 in July and 3 in August and 4 in September. And each deposition, we're going to have this many hours of partner time, associate time, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. That's a very time-consuming way of creating a budget. And I don't recommend that very often because in a litigation you might get into it and the opposing side files some motion and all depositions are put on hold. So I I generally actually start at the top and say, partner, what do you think the number is? And when they put out the number, I say, okay, now let's test that number. You know, what are the 5 or 10 factors that will drive that number significantly up? And a lot of times the partners will say, oh, there's 100 things. And I always say, well, let's start with the big ones. And I don't think I've ever made it past 10. And they're what you would think. Okay, it depends on opposing counsel. It depends on the opposing party. It depends on the judge. And if it's a deal, it can depend on the jurisdiction. And so it's all the factors you would think it would be. And I might say, okay, are any of these factors high probability? And if they say one is, I say, okay, then we need to adjust the number based on that it's highly likely that that's going to happen and drive the number up. So, and the other way I can test their number is to say, who's your team? How much of their time are we going to use for the next 6 months? And so it's a way of testing their number to say, is it a good number or is it a number we really need to question?
So you're asking them to start out with what they think the total legal cost will be.
Yeah, and it might be per phase.
Okay.
Or it might be for a period of time. In fact, the time factor is one of the best ways of trying to trap down a budget.
Okay.
To say, okay, this deal is going to close in 90 days, or, you know, we're only going to give a budget for the remainder of the year on this litigation, mm-hmm. because it's really hard to, you know, if you've got a 5-year litigation you're looking at, in my opinion, you're making stuff up if you're given a number
okay.
for the 5 years. So now you go through that process and you come up with a number you feel good about. Then typically what happens is those factors I talked about,
mm-hmm.
they become a list of assumptions or what you might call out-of-scope events.
Sure.
To say, if any of these 5 things happen, we need to sit back down and talk about the fee. Now, let's switch to the client side that you've laid out there. And you're absolutely right. It is on a client-by-client basis. And this is another reason the fees range from $9,000 to $900,000. It's that the client might look at it and say, okay, my goal with this piece of litigation is I want it to go away as fast as possible. And it might be because they want it off the books before the end of the year, or it might be their opinion is the longer litigation goes, the more it costs, so let's just get it done with. But on the other hand, and in fact, the $900,000 matter or example I gave you, that was actually a frontline worker for a company, and the reason it was so expensive is because the client said, we're concerned that this could establish precedents for other employees to sue us on this issue, so we don't want to lose. And so they were willing to pay a lot more because
right.
it wasn't just that employee with, you know, a $50,000 claim or whatever it was. It was a much bigger issue for them.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really understanding that client's drivers related to a deal or a case or whatever they're dealing with. So that hopefully that sort of covers both sides of the issue you've laid out there.
Okay. And you talk about a client-by-client basis. One of the things that has always been raised anytime somebody talks about value billing, and you know all the players in the field, it's always about the trust with the client. And it strikes me, A, that that's a truism, but B, how many of your clients, or any large firm clients, for that matter, any lawyer's clients, really have that kind of trusting relationship where you can say that we can and are a partner with that client, such that they don't object to our making money, number one. Number two, we have the ability to lay out an honest, candid conversation with them about what's going to drive the legal cost up, never mind the hourly rate, but the legal cost up or the legal cost down. How many trusting relationships like that are there?
Well, I think you might be surprised at how many are out there. However, I will say, you know, from a market level, the ones that are out there are strained right now. And you're actually, you know, singing my song, so to speak, here. When I have a lot of lawyers will call me, you know, at all my firms and even from other firms and say, okay, what types of alternative fees are the best ones? You know, is a fixed fee that the thing that's successful? And my answer to them is actually touches on all the themes you just laid out. I say the keys to a successful pricing arrangement are trust and communication. Because if you, and this is a big challenge for the industry, because lawyers both on client side and on law firm side really are uncomfortable having these conversations. Historically, and you know this, historically what would happen is the client would say, what are your rates? And the law firm would say, here are our rates, and that would be the end of the conversation. Whereas now the conversation has to be ongoing. Okay, you know, we're changing our strategy in the case. How does that impact the fee situation, and does that impact our strategy? And having that ongoing conversation. And this is one of my themes with the lawyers I work with. I say it's all about the conversation. That conversation is what will make this successful, regardless of the fees type or situation. So the foundation for trust is out there, but lawyers really need to pick up the ball and have these conversations with clients.
One of the interesting things that I find over and over again, it just kind of hits me like a sledgehammer, is one of the things I did when I was practicing law for 25 years was family law, divorce work. And, you know, my wife has a commentary. She says, every couple has 8 hours of tape, and we repeat those 8 hours over and over again. That's it. You know, and you can look at one couple or another couple, and you can identify which of the tapes, you know, where they are in the spectrum of those 8 hours of tapes. Okay. And those couples that I saw for the divorce were couples who stopped working the tapes. They stopped listening. They stopped communicating.
Yeah.
And it's true in partnership business breakups. Same thing. They get into a snit and they stop talking and they no longer have that honest conversation. And so, same thing with clients and lawyers. How can you have that conversation? You know, at what point is the lawyer comfortable enough that client will stay with him? I mean, I mentioned earlier the loyalty that I experienced when I was in the manufacturing world, where I and my company were the last ones called before a buyer in a supermarket made the decision, because he was loyal to us. He gave us the opportunity to either adjust what we were doing in the marketplace so that he could retain his job, you know, and be competitive, or for us to say we cannot do anything and we'll walk away from that business. Where is this in the conversation between the lawyer and, of course, the client who says, hey, you know, I want to get the best deal possible? And, oh, by the way, before you answer that question, Toby, there's at least 10 other law firms who would love to take that business from you.
Well, you're singing my song. I consider my highest value proposition to my law firm my conversations with clients. And I know not all lawyers are in a situation to have a resource like me, but effectively what I do is I jumpstart that conversation. And this is a growing role that I have. And in fact, in a week and a half, I'll be out in the western part of the United States meeting with the general counsel of a very large company. And what I'll be doing is sitting down with our lawyer and the general counsel, and you could call it facilitating, but it's really getting that conversation going to where and my goal in those conversations is getting the client to talk about their pain. And to give you a very typical example, the CEO has come to the general counsel with some mandate related to their budget and their outside legal spend. And the mandate can take different forms, and depending on which, you know, what that might be, and it might be something like, you know, you've hit on the issue of discounts. A lot of general counsels are asking for bigger discounts so that they can go back to their CEO and say, I got another 5%. See, I'm saving money, or I'm holding the line on spend. Now, are they? We don't know, actually. But if they're responding to their leadership and the CEO goes, okay, good job, keep it up, then they're performing in their job the way their boss told them to perform.
That sounds like the department store that raises the price just before Christmas and then has the discount of not 10% but 20%.
Yeah, I actually don't think just getting bigger discounts is an effective way to understand and control your legal spend.
No, but CFOs and even some CEOs use that as a metric.
That.
Right.
They'll buy that. Others might come back and say, well, they've asked me to take 5% off the top line of my outside counsel spend.
Mm-hmm.
Others might say, like, in fact, I've seen lately, it's not quite to where I will call it a trend, but a number of clients, the way they're measuring it is a weighted average hourly rate that they're spending. And what that tells them, I assume, is that the work's being pushed down to the right level and that the rates are reasonable. Again, I don't, you know, I'm not privy to what they're doing inside the client to use that as a metric, but if that's what their metric is and that's the way they measure success, that tells me the type of pricing arrangements we should be proposing to them.
So I think that what I hear you saying is, number one, you've got to understand your client. You got to understand what their needs are. You've got to understand what their how they value success, not how they value, but what they perceive success to be. And then you can adjust your thinking and perhaps even your approach, your proposal to them in those terms. Am I right?
Precisely, yeah.
Okay, let me ask you one other question. Again, because I don't want to belabor your goodwill in the time that we have available to us, although I would love to have a series of conversations with you because I love this. But from the perspective of the small firm lawyer who doesn't have Toby Brown at his or her elbow, how is it that that person can establish a fee or fee structure that is likely to be accepted by a client?
Well, let's attack it from kind of both angles. On the where they don't have someone like me to have conversations with the clients, my counsel to lawyers like that is, I get why you are uncomfortable having conversations about this with your client, because it has the appearance of putting you in opposition to your client, and that's an uncomfortable place for a lawyer to be. They want to be their client's advocate, not, you know, in opposition to their client. My response is that by having conversations about fees with your clients, you are actually helping your clients. You are becoming a partner to your clients and an advocate in a whole different way. Even in a divorce situation, it's, you know, and I may have purchased one or two divorces in my life, and I would have appreciated the lawyers having more frank conversations to say, you know, Toby, here's sort of the baseline of what a divorce might cost. Here's what's going to drive the price up, and here's what's going to drive the price down. Toby, here's what you can do to help control the cost. And if things become important to you, here's what it's going to cost, and so you'll know what it is. I would have considered, you know, I would have been grateful for that conversation. So having those conversations on the client side will have tremendous value in coming up with fees and prices that are positive for the client experience. Now, on the backside, you are going to have to start understanding the costs. A lot of times I'll get into dialogues with other people in the industry where they're like, there shouldn't be any billable hours. And my response is, well, you know, you have to think about that in two dimensions. One is the billing rate, but the other one is the cost rate. There are costs to the hours that go into delivering legal services. So if I have a fixed fee for a divorce of, you know, we'll say $20,000, I'm going to have a certain amount of my time as a partner in a firm, or my associate's time, or my paralegal's time, and that's going to be my cost of delivering that service. And so I need to start developing tools and approaches to understand that cost and what drives it up and what drives it down. So although you've already heard me comment that our current knowledge base of time and billing is it's poorly structured, I'll say, for this kind of stuff, we need to start changing that. And that comes with looking at this a little bit differently. Instead of saying, you know, I have an hourly rate and I have a profit built into that hourly rate, you have to start thinking, okay, I'm delivering a service and I'm getting revenue and I need to look at the cost of delivering that service. So on the sort of the back financial side of this, lawyers need to gain a better understanding of the cost of delivery and use that to, you know, not just to drive profitability, but to improve the services they provide. You know, is it the most, or are they using resources in a cost-effective manner? So two sides of the same coin there. But I really think these concepts apply at every level down to the solo practitioner.
I can't agree with you more. And one of the things that lawyers really do not know, and I think do not want to know because it takes a little energy on their part in a field with which they've generally not had experience, is how much does it cost to turn on the light switch every morning that they walk in the door? And what you're talking about is how much does it cost to run that particular case? And there are factors that drive the cost up. There are factors that allow the cost to go down. Coupled with that is the overhead, whether you're running a case or you're not running a case. And lawyers just don't pay attention to that. It's fascinating to me. But the other thing that they don't pay attention to, which this discussion might help them alleviate, is when they bill $100 an hour, but they collect $78 an hour, they are effectively running an operation in terms of their revenue at $78 an hour, and they don't understand it because they're spending at $100 an hour rate.
Yeah. I do a lot of presentations, internally and externally, on law firm profitability, and I'm sure I'm almost certain you're familiar with the old rule of three,
mm-hmm.
about how when you look at a timekeeper, you know, a third is comp, a third is overhead, and a third is profit. So you know that when you start discounting, where if you're getting 78 cents on the dollar, that's all coming out of profit. and so I pretty clearly will say to a lawyer, okay, a 5% discount equals somewhere between a 10 to 15% cut in your profits. So go ahead and give the 5%, but realize what it's doing to your bottom line. And that usually stops them cold.
That's out of their pocket.
Yeah.
Toby,
yeah.
I want to thank you very much. For me, it's been a joy to have this conversation. And I'm serious. I would love to have ongoing conversations with you. But I think that anybody who listens to this has to walk away with the understanding that being a fabulous lawyer, a very intelligent lawyer, is really important, but it's only part of the picture. And we have to include our clients in our conversations far more than we do. Again, Toby, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
You have been listening to a Law Biz podcast. For more podcasts, please visit www.lawbiz.com/podcasts.html. You can read more about this and other topics from the business of law at www.lawbizblog.com, or start your own discussion about this topic at www.lawbizforum.com. Join today. Feel free to tell your friends and colleagues about Law Biz Podcasts. You may duplicate this program in part or in whole, provided that you retain appropriate attribution and copyright notices.